أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا أبو القاسم محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters. It's my honor to be here in front of you on this Friday night speaking to you, and I thank you for giving me this opportunity. The previous speech was very good because actually it fits into the topic a little bit, because at first I wanted to speak about Sayyida Zainab a little bit, but the brother did, and he talked about her patience. He talked about how we could use her patience in our lives. And it's, inshallah, you guys listened to that speech. It was a very good speech. Now, on these Friday nights, for the short period of time that I'm here, I'll be here for maybe 1 month, 2 months, for however long I'm here, I wanted to start a topic and we'll go over it. You will continue it every week. So I picked one of the sermons from Najo Balaga, the 192nd sermon. It's called Al-Qasi'. Now, this is an interesting sermon. It's a sermon that, inshallah, over time will become more familiar with. And I encourage all of you, inshallah, when you go home, to read it, so you could have, you would have a little bit in your minds about what we want to talk about. Now, first of all, in the Hawza, when we go into the Hawza, you learn how to analyze every single thing. You have to look at everything. So the first thing we're going to look at is the name of this sermon, Qasi'. Why is it called Qasi'? What does Qasi'? Mean? What relationship does this word have with this speech itself, with the sermon that Imam Ali alayhi salam delivered? Now, first, it's not very important, so I'm not going to take too much time on this. The reason why it's not important is because Imam Ali himself did not name the sermon. The sermon was named after him. The compiler of Najo Balaga is the one who named this sermon. So it's not important what name it was given, as you know, it's not something that is from the Imams. But there's two possibilities that are given, and there's some more that are weaker. The first possibility is that Qasi'a is an attribute of a camel who regurgitates its food. The camel throws up its food and then eats it again, and throws it up again and eats it again. This type of camel is called Qasi'a. And when Imam Ali alayhi salam was giving this speech, he was sitting on top of that camel. So that's why it's called Qasi'a. The second one, which Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi gives, says that the second meaning is the most probable meaning, is that Qasi'a means, as he says, means like a very fiery speech, a very energetic speech, a speech where Imam Ali pounds his opposition, and we'll discuss who they are later on. Now, or what you call a hammer speech, or something like this, and you see that there's different types of speeches. I mean, I was talking with one of the sisters the other day. Some speeches are informative. Some speeches are, what's it called, self-help type speeches. And some speeches, you have to attack the people you're talking to. In this speech, Imam Ali was attacking the people he was talking to. He was speaking very harshly to them. He was speaking very loudly. He was trying to pound his point into their heads. And this is why it's important for us, because it's something that Imam Ali had so much enthusiasm about. It was so important for Imam Ali that he attacked his people. He attacked the people he was talking to make sure that they listened to him, to make sure that they understood what he was saying, and to make sure that they tried to implement it in their lives. Inshallah, can you please recite a salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now this speech, it was delivered at the end of Imam Ali's caliphate. So after the 25 years that he remained silent after the Prophet's death, and then about 4 years after that, after his caliphate, this is when he delivered this speech. He was addressing his army. He was addressing people who were fighting for him, not against him. He was addressing the people who were, you know, on his side. And the first thing that he was telling them is that they're fanatics, that you guys have become fanatical. And we know that Islam is against fanaticism. Islam is against anything that's fanatical, especially the Ahlul Bayt sect. In the Ahlul Bayt sect, we have so many ahadith, so many hadiths, which always tell us, don't go to either side of the extremes, always stay in the middle path. On many different subjects, always stay on the middle path. That's something that as Shia, we have to learn. We have to try to implement that in our lives. We can never become fanatical. We can never go to an extreme. Now, you could apply that to many things. For instance, the topic of Irfan is something that I've been hearing about since I've come here. That's the only thing people are talking about. Now, Irfan is something that, again, one can be fanatical about, or one could be on the middle path. One can go to either extreme. So, for instance, one of the extremes of Irfan would be saying, Irfan is something that's useless. We don't need Irfan. All we have to do is pray. We have to be good in our hearts. We have to love Allah. But we don't have to, you know, struggle and strive and try to better ourselves. That's one side of the extreme. The other side of the extreme is going so far, right, where you're taking things that aren't from the Ahlul Bayt, where you're doing things that the Ahlul Bayt did not tell us to do, where you're becoming more, you know, you're becoming holier than the Ahlul Bayt, right? And we see this in many different groups. You see this in groups in Iran, in groups outside of Iran. You see this all over the place, where people try to take one step too far. They bring things that they learn in other countries or other cultures. They try to get closer through diets or through whatever it may be. And they become fanatical on that side as well. So what's the middle course in Irfan? What's the middle course in Islamic spirituality? If we're not supposed to go to either extreme, what are we supposed to do? Now, in Islamic akhlaq or Irfan, there's many books that are written, there's many different styles that are presented, but the main two things that we have to work, pay attention to is the teacher. Okay? In Irfan, it's different than reading a book. Anyone could read a book and you could get whatever you want out of that book. But in Irfan, what you do is you're trying to go somewhere that you haven't been, and you need a person who has been there to tell you how to get there, to tell you what to watch out for, to say if you look that way, it's going to be problematic. You have to take, you know, a step this way to do it. They have to be able to show you this. It has to be someone who's able to do this. So the teacher is the most important thing. The two qualities that this teacher should have. Number one is ijtihad. If he's not a mujtahid, he's not a qualified teacher in this field. And I'll tell that to anybody, and I'll argue that with anybody. Why do I say that? What is ijtihad first? Ijtihad means the ability to derive Islamic rulings or Islamic principles from the sources of Islam, from the Quran, from the hadith. If someone's not able to use these sources of Islam to derive Islamic opinion, how would they be able to tell you what Islamic's view on Irfan is? How would they be able to tell you that, you know, in order to reach stage one, you have to do this. In order to reach stage two, you have to do that. How would they be able to do that if they can't use the sources? If they're not able to read them, if they're not able to use them in the correct manner. So the first thing is ijtihad. The second thing that is necessary is that they have to have been given permission by a credible source. And this is also very important, because a lot of people have a lot of knowledge, but just having knowledge is not enough. They might not be people who act in accordance to their knowledge. They might have, you know, their own personal desires. They might have their own personal agenda. But if it's someone who's been given permission, you could feel safe with him. Now, who has the authority to give permission? Who is it that can give permission? It's the people who are well known, that there's no doubt about them. And in Qom, and there's other houses as well, but I'm in Qom. In Qom, there's what's it called? There's this line of these teachers that we have, that everyone who is into this field can feel comfortable about. Right? There's a few generations back, there was a person by the name of Qazi Tabatabai. I don't know if you know him. But he's very famous. Everyone knows him, respects him, trusts him. He gave permission to Allama Tabatabai. Allama Tabatabai, the one who wrote Tafsir al-Mizan and other books. Some books are translated to English of his. Then he gave permission to a number of people. There's 4 or 5 people right now that are alive that he gave permission to. So there are people alive, there are people trustworthy, and there are people that we can go to. But we have to be careful if we want to, you know, if we want to take steps on the path of Irfan, we have to be careful who our teacher is. This is something that's very important, and I'm going to leave the discussion at that with the salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now, another thing that Imam Ali alayhi salam was attacking his own army about, another thing that Imam Ali alayhi salam was, you know, angry with his people over, was that they were falling back into tribalism or racism, right? The Prophet, but in the age of ignorance, we know that racism or tribalism was rampant in the Arab Peninsula. We know that, it's a fact. When the Prophet came, he destroyed racism. He said that, you know, the race of a person, being an Arab or non-Arab, being a member of this tribe or that tribe, is not important. What's important is piety. After the Prophet passed away, through these 25 years that Imam Ali was waiting for the caliphate, slowly, this feeling or this sense or this belief in racism started creeping back into this society. It started coming back. And Imam Ali was upset about this. Now, as a convert, as someone who's not one of the main races of Islam, I see this a lot, because I'm an outsider and I look in and I see a lot of racism in our communities. But actually in this community here in Sydney, in this center, alhamdulillah, it's one of the only centers I've seen that's mixed race, that does everything in English, that I haven't seen any, you know, sort of racism here at all, and it's something you should be proud of. It's something that is not seen, you know, many places. I've gone in Europe, in America, in Iran, in other places, and I haven't seen anywhere like this to this extent. So it's something you guys should be proud of. But as a convert, there's a lot of times, inshallah, in a few weeks, I'll talk more about this subject, because Imam Ali alayhi salam will get into it, and I'll get into it more depth. But just one thing as a convert that I see, and I don't know if there's any other converts here or not, but one thing that usually we see that we face is that people don't believe that we know how to practice our religion, no matter how long we're Muslim. There's one sister that came to me, and she was very upset, not here, somewhere else. She was a Muslim for like 30 years, I think. She was a Muslim since she was a teenager, and she was like almost 50. And she's like, Hamid, I don't know what it is. Why can't people accept that I know how to pray, I know how to do wudu, I know how to do this. I said, what happened? She said, I went to a camp. In America, camps are something that's popular. They take people on little camps for a week or for a weekend or something, and they give Islamic teaching, and then they go back to their lives. So she went to a camp, and in this camp, they separated the adults from the children. So the adults would receive, like, there was a couple sheikhs there, they had some speeches. The children were getting basic classes on how to do wudu, how to pray, how to fast, and this. And they put her in the kids' class. And she was really upset about this. She even, like, wanted to leave the camp, and I told her, stay, go sit in the other speeches. But she was upset. And for me, it's happened to me as well. In Iran, it happens a lot. I'll be in a taxi, the person will start speaking to me, he'll learn that I'm from America, I'll be wearing these clothing, and he'll ask me, oh, are you Shia? I say, yeah, I'm Shia. I've been in here studying for 10 years, how am I not a Shia? Or there's one person in my wife's family who lives in a village, he'll come and visit us, and he sees me in these clothes, and he says, oh, so you're from America, do you know how to pray, do you pray? I say, so what am I supposed to say? I said, well, sometimes, once in a while I pray. So I mean, you see this a lot. Alhamdulillah, I'm saying in this center we don't have it. But it's still something to look out for. And inshallah, I'll get into more depth inshallah later. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now the main reason why Imam Ali alayhi salam was angry with his army, the main reason that Imam Ali alayhi salam wanted to, you know, attack them verbally was because of arrogance. So So what I said before is part of the sermon, but the main sermon is about their arrogance. And Imam Ali alayhi salam says that arrogance destroyed the social, you know, their social fiber, destroyed their personal and social interactions, destroyed their ideology, destroyed the way they look at the world, their religion, and everything. It's because arrogance grew in them, and Imam Ali wanted to destroy this arrogance, wanted to hit them back into their places, knock them back into their places. Now, we'll start with the first sentence of the sermon, and inshallah, each Friday we'll go over another sentence or another phrase. So the first sentence is this: Alhamdulillah alladhi labisa al-izza wal kibriya. Praise be to God who has who wears the apparel of honor and dignity, izza and kibriya. We'll discuss those terms. First of all, it's an interesting it's an interesting example that Imam Ali is giving here. He's saying that Allah wears the clothes of honor and dignity. First of all, as in the Friday speech, the Sheikh said that Allah does not have a body. So it's clear that these clothes are not physical clothes. Honor and dignity are not physical. But let's take it a step further. Now, what does clothing mean? Clothing means a covering, something that covers your body, something that will cover the divine essence, right? So this honor and this dignity is covering the divine essence. What does that mean? Does it mean that there's an essence here, and then there's something called honor that's added to this essence, and something called dignity that's added to this essence? Essence is in Kibriyar added to the divine essence? Is that what Imam Ali is saying? Or is it something different? We know that he can't be saying that, because we know that the attributes are not something that's added to the essence of Allah. The attributes are the essence of Allah. Every attribute altogether is the exact essence. And we'll get into that a little bit here. So this covering, this wearing the clothes of honor and dignity, it's figurative in every way you look at it. Okay? So it's not something to be taken literal. It's not something that you think that there's something added to the essence of Allah. That's the first thing that we have to get into. Now, Allah has many attributes. There's 99 attributes mentioned in the Quran. There's 1,000 attributes mentioned in the Dua Joshin Kabir. There's many attributes of Allah. There's active attributes. There's what's it called? Essential attributes. For instance, knowledge, life, power. All of these are attributes. Allah has all of them. But they are all the same. They're all one in the same. So that means knowledge. When we say that Allah is knowledgeable, when Allah is the most knowledgeable, it also means he's the most powerful. When we say he's the most powerful, it means he's the most merciful. When we say he's the most merciful, it means he's the living. When we say he's the living, it means he's the punisher. All of them are the same. It's difficult for us to comprehend that everything is the same, that all of the attributes are the exact essence. This is something that you have to sit down and you have to really think over, and you have to try to figure out what it means. Because when we use these attributes, we use them differently. If we're talking about a human being, if we're talking about a person, we use them differently. For instance, let's say there's this one person. We say, this guy, Zayd, he's knowledgeable and he's powerful. And he has strength, he's strong. We're saying two different things. We're saying one thing, he has knowledge, and number two, he has strength. And to prove that these aren't the same, you could see that there's that a person exists that, you know, has knowledge but not strength. For instance, Stephen Hawking, who's a scientist, he has a lot of knowledge, but he's on a wheelchair, and he doesn't have any strength, he's paralyzed. Or for instance, on the other side, people who are strong without any knowledge, some athletes, I hope there's no athletes here, but some athletes, a lot of athletes, they're not the smartest people in the world, at least in America. Maybe in Australia they're smart, in America they're not. For instance, let's say football, American football, which you guys don't like, you like rugby. In American football they have, there's this guy I was reading the other day. He's a running back. Do you know what a running back is? A running back is the small guy who gets the ball and runs with it, and then the big guys try to hit him to fall down. So this running back, He tries to run a lot of yards. The football field is 100 yards. I have to teach you football. Now, this guy, he said this. He said, he was asked, you know, at the beginning of the season, what do you want to accomplish this year? What do you want to do this year? He said, I want to run 1,000 yards or 1,500 yards, whichever comes first. Right? Whatever comes first. These people, you know, they're not the brightest people in the world. They're strong, but they're not bright. So this proves that strength and knowledge are not the same thing. But when we talk about it with Allah, they are the same thing. Because why is this the case? Why can't we use the attributes the way we use them with people with Allah as well? Why can't we say that Allah's knowledge is different than His power? That Allah's being alive is different than His compassion. Why can't we say they're different? Because if we say that, then we're saying that Allah has parts. We're saying here's a divine essence. Part number one is His mercy. Part number two is His compassion. Part number three is His, you know, He's a punisher. Part number four, He's the forgiver. Part number five, He's omnipotent, and so on. And if something has parts, they're dependent upon those parts. If something has parts, they're dependent. For instance, knowledge. For me to know something, I'm dependent on the knowledge that I have. If this knowledge is taken away from me, I don't know anything anymore. For me to be powerful, I'm dependent on my strength, on my body. If this power is taken away from me and I'm what's it called? I don't know, whatever happens and this power is taken away from me, then I won't be able to move anymore. I'll be paralyzed. But Allah, that's not the case. If Allah wants to, you know, create something, He's not dependent on this power, on His ability. He just does it. If Allah's knowledge, He's not dependent upon His knowledge to know something. His knowledge is His essence. His power is His essence. I know this is difficult, but hopefully you guys could think about it a little bit, inshallah, and inshallah in the future we'll get into it more in more depth. Also, this class that I'm going to be teaching, the comparative theology class, this is one of the subjects that's discussed. So if you still have questions, you could go there and inshallah we'll discuss it further. And you'll be able to ask me questions as well. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Now back to the sentence of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Alhamdulillah alladhi labasa al-izza wal-kibriya. Izza, we translate it as honor. But it's not an exact translation. Sometimes there's Arabic words that don't have exact English translations, and we have to do with what we have. Now, izza first, this is something that is used in our everyday speech. We say that, you know, each other, we have honor, we have izzah. Someone's our aziz, we use these words. Is that correct to use them? Or does izzah belong only to Allah? Is izzah only a divine attribute and we can't use it for humans at all? Now, of course, the absolute form of this izzah is for Allah. The perfect form of this attribute only Allah has. Humans don't have it. Humans might be able to have smaller doses or smaller levels of this attribute, but the perfect form, only Allah. Allah is one that does not bow to anybody, and He cannot be overpowered by anybody. And this is something that we Shia believe, Muslims believe this, and it's one of our most important articles of faith. It's actually one of the things that led me to Islam itself. Because when I was younger, when I was 16 years old, I was searching religion. And I searched many different religions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhist, I don't know, Hare Krishna, all kinds of things. And one of the things that stood out for me in Islam was their concept of God. That God is one, that He's the all-powerful, that nothing compares to Him, and nothing can be compared to Him. But in other religions, you don't have that. In Christianity, you have a God that has three parts, if only three, probably even more than that. In Judaism also, you have a God that is not Aziz. You have a God that was overpowered. And when I heard one story about this in Judaism, I turned away and never looked back. There's a story in the Bible. It says that, or in the Torah, the Old Testament, it talks about Prophet Yaqub, Prophet Jacob. And it says that one day Jacob started wrestling with God. God has a body, and they were wrestling together. And not only were they wrestling, Jacob overpowered God. Jacob pinned God down, and God couldn't get up. And Jacob was holding him down because he wanted God to give him whatever he wanted. He wanted progeny and wealth and all this. So he's holding him down until God submits, right? And then the sun is about to come up, and God tells Jacob, this is Auzu Billah, of course this is complete, ridiculous, but God tells Jacob, let me up so the people don't see me like this, right? And if you do, I'll give you whatever you want. I'll give you your 12 tribes, whatever. I'll give you everything. So then, what's it called? Jacob let him go, and God gave him whatever he wanted. So that's what's in the Bible. And if you compare that to Islam, you would see why someone would choose Islam instead of Judaism or other things like this. But God is the one who is the most powerful. God is the one, he doesn't bow down to anybody. He's not overpowered by anything. And this is the absolute form of this attribute called izzah, called honor. It's very important. Now, when we look in the Quran, the answer to the question is izzah only for Allah, or can it be applied to other people as well? And the answer to this is going to show you the difference between izzah and kibriya, between honor and dignity. In the Quran, we have many verses which use this term. I'm going to mention three of them. But first, I'm going to talk a little bit about intercession. In the Quran, a lot of you, I'm sure, have read about intercession, about shifa. And we see that there's many different categories of verses about intercession in the Quran. One of them says, one category says, there will be no intercession, right? Another category says, there will be only intercession, intercession will only occur with the permission of Allah. Third category is intercession, where Allah is saying, these people, the prophets, the salihin, the righteous, the truthful, these people will have the power of intercession through my permission. We have three types of verses. About izzah, we have the same thing. There's these same three types of verses. One category says that izzah is only with Allah. فَلِلَّهِ الْإِزَّةِ جَمِيعًا. Izzah in its entirety is for Allah. Nobody else. Right? Second verse says that Allah will give izzah to whoever He wants. تُعِزُّ مَنْ تَشَى. Allah will honor someone, give izzah to whoever He wants. The third verse says that izzah is given to certain people. One person and then a group of people. And it's وَلِلَّهِ الْعِزَّةِ وَلِرَسُولِهِ وَلِلْمُؤْمِنِينَ وَلَكِنَ الْمُنَافِقِينَ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ. It says this, izzah is for Allah and for the messenger and for the believers. And of course, the top of the believers are the imams and the one living right now, Imam Zaman, ajallahu farajhu sharif. And all of the mu'mineen have izzah. But the hypocrites don't know. The hypocrites are unaware of this. They think that they have izzah, but they're not the ones with izzah. Now, if you look at these three verses, they're interesting. And it's going to take me back to what I was saying on Sunday, where let's say someone only takes the first verse, that izzah in its entirety is for Allah, that Allah is the only one that has izzah. He takes this verse and he reads it, just as some Muslims have done with the verse on intercession. They take the verse that says there's no intercession at all. There won't be any intercession. They take that verse and they say the Shia are whatever, disbelievers, or the Shia are misguided, or the Shia are whatever. Why? Because they state that the imams have the power of intercession. When in the Quran it says that there's no intercession. They don't look at the other verses. They only take that one verse without looking at everything together. And that's dangerous. That's something that I see, inshallah, not in this community, but I see a lot all over the place, where someone will take a verse of the Quran or they'll take a hadith and without comparing it to all the other verses and hadiths on that subject, without comparing it to the words of the ulama, they'll derive by themselves, they'll derive some, what's it called, some interpretation of this verse or of this hadith, and they'll state that it's the Islamic interpretation, that this is Islam. But that's not true. Who are we? What comprehensive knowledge of Islam do we have that we could read one hadith and say that Islam says this? No. Look at the Muraja. They study since they're children. A lot of them entered the Hawza 13 years old, 14 years old. And they study even now. They're still studying when they're in their 70s. They would have maybe 20 PhDs if you compare it to a Western university. They're amazing individuals. These are people who have a comprehensive knowledge of Islam. These are people who could read a hadith and then could compare it with all the other hadiths or other verses and then derive an Islamic opinion and say Islam says this. But when the likes of me and you do this, it's dangerous. So am I saying not to read hadith? No, read the hadith. Read books on Islam. But don't come to your own conclusions about them and say that it's Islam. Don't interpret them in such a way that you correlate them to some, you know, some situation that you're facing and you say that Islam says this, this backs my opinion up. No. What you should do is you should listen to the ulama, to the people who have studied, you know, a number of years in the Hawza and take their opinions about these verses and hadiths. And inshallah in the future we'll discuss this more as well. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So we saw in the verse, we saw that izzah, the absolute perfect form of izzah or honor is for Allah. But it could also be applied to the messenger and the believers. So, you know, lesser amounts of honor of izzah applies to them. So izzah can be applied to both Allah and human beings. But kibriya is different. Kibriya stems from the root kibr, and it means arrogance. It means thinking that you're important, right? Now, it's different than self-esteem. I don't want to get this confused with, you know, self-esteem. We should have self-esteem. Self-esteem is a good trait. We should think that we're, you know, we're good people or whatever self-esteem. I'm sure the doctor could explain self-esteem better than me. But self-esteem is something that's positive. Thinking that we're important, this isn't self-esteem. What it is it's important in such a way that the world revolves around us, or our family revolves around us, or our community revolves around us, that we are the center of the world. We are the most important thing alive. This is what kibriya is. Nothing is more important than us. This is what this means. Now, there's different levels of it, of course. Some people in their family, they say, I'm the most, you know, I'm the husband, and I make the money, and if I'm not here, the family will fall. The family will crumble and go away. I'm the most important thing. Everything depends on me, so everyone else should serve me. Or in the community, I'm the sheikh. I went and I studied for 10 years. I know what Islam says. You guys don't know anything. You guys have to follow whatever I say because I'm important. You guys have to serve me. Or even gets up higher than that. Some people, you know, they get so, they let this thought go in their minds for so much that they actually think that they're divine. We have Pharaoh. What did Pharaoh say? فَقَالَ أَنَّ رَبَكُمُ الْعَلَى. Pharaoh said, you know, I'm the high Lord. I'm your high Lord. Right? He said he knows that he didn't create everything. There's no matter how much I could believe that I'm important, that I'm divine, that I'm something, I know that I didn't create this pen. I know that I didn't create plastic. I'm not the one who did everything. There's no way you could trick yourself into that. So he knew he wasn't God, but he had so much arrogance that he let himself believe that the world would not go on without him. This is Kibriya. And Allah rebukes people. Allah speaks so negatively about this trait in the Quran. Anyone who has this, it's very bad. For instance, there's one verse, I'll read the English. Indeed, those who dispute the signs of Allah without any authority. So there's people who dispute the signs of Allah. There's people who argue with Allah. They argue against the Quran. They argue against the clear statements of religion. The clear, you know, the necessities of religion. They argue against them without any authority. They have no right to do so. They have no proof. They have no, you know, they're nothing. They have no authority. Then there is only vanity in their breast, in their chest. And vanity here is this kibr. They only think that they're so important. They think that they're everything. These are the type of people who fight against religion. These are the type of people that Allah dislikes, or at least he dislikes his quality. So here the difference between Izzah and Kibriya is clear. Izzah is something, the absolute form of it is only for Allah. But lesser forms of it can be attributed to others. While Kibriya, the true form of Kibriya, meaning that the one who thinks himself important is actually important. That Allah is the only one who could say, the world revolves around me. Allah is the only one that could say, the universe without me would be nothing. And no human could make such a claim, a truthful claim. No human could have 1% of that attribute in their being. That's the difference between Izzah and Kibriya. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.